Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why do some traumas haunt us long after the danger has passed? Accounts of suffering that resembles what we now call post-traumatic stress disorder date back at least as far as Homer, who wrote of warriors plagued by survival guilt and struggling to return to the civilized world they once belonged in. Today, 27 million Americans are believed to have suffered from PTSD at some point, including as many as 3 in 10 veterans of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The condition clearly affects brain function, but its symptoms are not easily eliminated by medications that regulate brain chemistry, and PTSD has repercussions whose effects reach far beyond the individuals who suffer from it. My guest today understands this from both a personal and a professional viewpoint. Journalist David J. Morris is a veteran of the U.S. Marine Corps. Following his military career, he reported as a war correspondent from Iraq from 2004 to 2007, after which he came to realize that his numerous experiences with trauma had left him feeling alienated, nervous, and angry, plagued by bad dreams and disturbing memories. Morris's new book explores what it is about PTSD and what is known, and also what remains a mystery to scientists and sufferers alike. The book is called The Evil Hours, a biography of post-traumatic stress disorder. Dave, welcome to Think.
Hi, thanks for having me.
For a long time, you write, you were skeptical about PTSD and whether it was really a thing or whether it was simply, I don't know, did you think it was a kind of sort of weakness among people who thought they had it?
Well, I mean, as a writer and as a former Marine, I just sort of thought of PTSD as like a cop-out. Mm-hmm. You know, I came back from Iraq in 2004 with a lot of feelings and a lot of confused thoughts and anger at what I'd seen and what had been going on in Iraq that I didn't think Americans really were taking seriously enough. And you know, as a writer, I really wanted to kind of have my own journey and write about it and come out the other side with this brilliant book in my hand. And I didn't think, and PTSD felt like a shortcut. Hmm. It felt like this diagnosis, these four letters that basically were a way to dodge responsibility for my choices and for what both my service as a Marine, which was in peacetime, and then my choices as a young man who wanted to be a war correspondent, who wanted to live the romantic life of someone who got shot at and wrote about it. And, you know, and I think that feeling still persists a little bit. And I think as I write about in the book, PTSD is an incredibly powerful, helpful therapeutic concept, but it doesn't encompass everything. It doesn't encompass the entirety of a survivor's or a veteran's experience. And so I want people to think about that, this, you know, and there's a lot more to say about this, but PTSD is this idea that's become the medicalization of loss, this medicalization of pain, you know, which is very, historically speaking, the idea of going to see a psychiatrist in the wake of warfare or in the wake of rape, in the wake of a natural disaster like a tsunami, this is completely new. It's never happened before. In the past, we would always go to priests, to shamans, and to poets. And to faith healers and to our family and our community. And now we go to a hospital. And this fact alone is worthy of greater meditation.
Well, when you think about it in those terms, there's this sense maybe in going to your shaman or your priest or your faith healer or just your community, there's this need to make meaning out of suffering.
Yeah, and that's sort of one of the fundamental concerns about surviving a war or surviving a rape is that it doesn't make sense. It's incommunicable. Every novelist wrestles with this idea that you can't, that there are things so awful in the world that they cannot, that words do not do them justice, that you can get close, but you can't really capture its essence, which, you know, it's war and these things, you know, they are sort of the immortal human subjects. You know, the Iliad, the Odyssey, Homer's work, these are the foundational documents of Western literature and Western consciousness, and they are about war. So war, you know, even though poets have wrestled with it for millennia, there is this problem of capturing this almost mystical side of it. But, you know, through one of the points I make in the book is that, you know, one of the most powerful technologies and time-tested technologies for healing is literature, you know, which is totally like a, you know, English high school teacher thing to say. but I've spoken to, and speaking for myself, reading the works of Tim O'Brien, the things they carried, reading the works of Phil Clay, his great short story collection, Redeployment. These stories are medicine. They help conceptualize, they help organize, they help identify emotions and feelings and thoughts that you are having, that you may be having about your wartime experience or your rape. Alice Siebold has written an excellent memoir called Lucky that describes her being raped and eventually putting her rapist in prison. And that heroic journey that you see in books like Lucky and The Things They Carried and The Iliad and The Odyssey help, number one, help us understand that we're not alone, that these are struggles, that the struggles that we are wrestling with are the struggles of eternity, that Achilles struggled with these things, that Audie Murphy, a World War II veteran, the most decorated soldier in American history, struggled with these things, and to understand its heroic power, and to on the most fundamental level, name the emotions that you are going through. And this is this sounds like an obvious thing, like that's what all books do, right? But in fact, you know, a lot of veterans that I talk to from around the country, you know, you're trained, you know, as a combat engineer or a sniper or an infantryman to kill and to operate without reflection as much as possible. And books, literature, poetry, and to a far lesser extent, films, these works of art allow us to name and to understand our emotions. And there is, and I'm saying this as a writer, but I'm also saying this as someone who's read the peer-reviewed science that says one of the best ways to prepare for a job interview, one of the best ways to prepare yourself for professional life is to read novels. They help develop a theory of mind. They help us empathize with other people, and they help us to understand ourselves. So that's sort of one of the, when I wrote this book, I wanted to look at the nuts and bolts of PTSD and what we know today and how the VA's war and how medicine's war on PTSD is being waged. But I also wanted to step back as far as I possibly could from the subject and still be on the planet Earth and think about it in really general terms. What is PTSD? From a certain standpoint, it's an inability to live in the present, an inability to enjoy life in the now, and it's an inability to have a narrative, a meaningful narrative story of your life. And veterans that you talk to from Iraq, Afghanistan, Vietnam will tell you that, and I feel this way myself. I often tell my friends, well, I feel like it's still 2004, the first time I went to Iraq. And that's a feeling that persists to this day. Everything about me changed that year. Everything I know, you know, my relationship to my country, my relationship to myself, my relationship to my service, all of these things changed that year. So there is this failure to live in the present that I continue to wrestle with, and that you know, a lot of veterans and virtually all PTSD survivors wrestle with this failure to, you know, I argue in the book that PTSD is a disease of time, which is an idea that still resonates even as I say it now.
What's remarkable about that idea that PTSD gets people sort of stuck in time is that your embrace of literature, you're sort of going right to something that absolutely takes you into a different time or a different place than you're actually existing in the moment. Is there something about doing that through the stories of other people that is maybe more palatable than looking directly back at your own experiences?
Yeah, I think so. And I think just, it's not an avoidance of the self or an avoidance of any kind of personal thought or introspection, but instead, you know, good novels, good, you know, literature of all kinds. You know, I'm thinking of Slaughterhouse-Five, The Naked and the Dead by Norman Mailer. These books push us and connect us with different people that are not us and that allow us to live vicariously through another character. And this gives us a knowledge of ourselves. The Greeks had a word for this, catharsis. And in fact, one of the things that's interesting is as you look at the history of war trauma throughout the West and throughout the world, you find that that drama and art played a giant role in how the Greeks, the ancient Greeks, the Spartans, the Athenians, how they processed war trauma. And in particular, they did it through staged plays. And these playwrights like Euripides, who wrote who was himself a veteran, and his plays were performed by other Greek soldiers. And so the idea was, through the act of working through this drama, there could be a public, both a personal and a public reconciliation and a public understanding of what their war experience has been.
Maybe there was something for the Greeks, too, in, I don't know entirely how they conceived of body versus soul versus mind. I would imagine that they saw these things as perhaps more unified than we do in the modern, highly scientific world.
Yeah, in fact, they did. I mean, they did. There was this sense of the Dionysian, the infinite, the infinity of man's consciousness, and how in warfare, warriors are taken to a different place, and there is a different spirit that governs the war, the place of war. And I think, you know, Western medicine comes from Hippocrates, comes from the Greeks, and there is, you know, all of, you know, and physicians today take the Hippocratic Oath. This is one of the foundational aspects of our scientific culture. And interestingly, the Greeks did not consider war trauma or anything remotely like PTSD to be something worthy of medical consideration. Hippocrates and a number of early Greek physicians considered depression or melancholia to be a medical condition. So they were certainly not averse to psychiatric, you know, the beginnings of psychiatric thinking, but they did not consider nightmares or the hysterical blindness, for instance, that is reported by Herodotus. They didn't consider that to be a medical problem, which is interesting. And it's only relatively recently, and this is one of the points I make in the book, is that PTSD as a medical concept is very, very new. It's one of the newest psychiatric disorders that's been recognized. It was only recognized in 1980 after the end of the Vietnam War. So our ideas of it are very modern and really informed by the media and really still very much a product of Vietnam. So we have a long way to go in terms of having a more soulful and spiritual and aesthetic and integrated sense of what trauma is.
What do we know about the impact of our emotions in the moment we experience a trauma and how they cause us to record and process those events and sort of have them, you know, etched into our memories?
Well, it's interesting. When I was writing this book, I interviewed a very thoughtful, very smart, influential neuroscientist named Jim McGaw, who works at University of California, Irvine. And McGaw has been looking for a very long time at why. His first idea is that not all memories are created equal. Some memories haunt us more than others. Some things we don't remember at all. And what he found was emotion, and particularly emotionally significant events, like our first kiss, the first time, you know, for a young man, who his first fight, his first baseball game, these sorts of things that have a particular emotional resonance, a particular power, tend to be remembered far more exhaustively, far more completely than other normal memories that we, you know, say the commute to work. We don't remember much of what we do as we're driving. And interestingly, he found that the way your adrenaline system, your flight, flight, or freeze response, the degree to which that is engaged as you are in the middle of a scary moment, that affects the way that memory is recorded. So there is this adrenaline component to how memories are recorded that is sort of at the genesis of what we call PTSD in terms of how memories are made.
My guest is journalist and Marine Corps veteran David J. Morris. We're talking about his new book, The Evil Hours, a biography of post-traumatic stress disorder. You can be part of our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for summer and fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/mls.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Marine Corps veteran and journalist David J. Morris. His new book is called The Evil Hours, a biography of post-traumatic stress disorder. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So, Dave, you endured a number of frightening and traumatic experiences, one terrible day in particular. And it turns out that the risk for PTSD is, in fact, increased among people who have had more than one horrible thing happen.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing. The research shows us is that if you one trauma tends to soften a person up for the next one. What is sometimes the next one? And research shows that if someone comes from, for instance, a abusive family context, an alcoholic father, didn't go to the best school, didn't have an opportunity to go to community college or to college. All of these things, and one's relationship with one's father or mother, all these factors can sort of play into who is more likely to get PTSD than the other than others. And in my situation, it was 2007. It was one of my last embedded assignments in Iraq. I was in this neighborhood in southern Baghdad called Sadia, and I was in a patrol with the 1st Infantry Division, and we drove down the street. That turned out to be a cul-de-sac, so we had to turn around and take a patrol back to base. And as my Humvee was backing up to do kind of a three-point turn, we ran over an IED, which blew up half the rear half of the Humvee and lit it on fire. And so it took us like 20 minutes later, we were back at the patrol base. No one was wounded physically, although everyone had lost their hearing except for me, which was mysterious. And I never really understood how that happened. Half hour later, I was back at a large forward operating base having my head examined, and then a week later, I was back in California. So there is sort of this quick sequence of events for me in terms of my final days in Iraq. But prior to that, I had spent several months the year before in Ramadi, which at that point was the deadliest city in Iraq. And prior to being blown up the final time in Saidiya, I had spent 2 weeks in Dora, which was an incredibly deadly neighborhood adjacent to Saidiya in southern Baghdad. And I'll never forget walking into the infantry battalion headquarters. When you walk in Iraq, they would have photos on the wall of all the soldiers that had been killed on that deployment. And as I walked into the command post for the first time, I saw that there were 17 photos on the wall. So there were 17 soldiers had already been killed, and two more were killed while I was there. And when you see these sorts of things, and that just goes to show as a symbol, like that was when you are in a war situation. If you're in Helmand Province or in the Korangal Valley in Afghanistan, you're dealing with indirect fire, the possibility of getting shot in the face every single day. So there is this daily incremental of cumulative impact. Your body changes when you're exposed to that level of stress for an extended period of time. You sleep differently. You sleep less. It's harder to get to sleep, and you wake up more. And I think it's important for people to recognize that there is this tendency to think of, okay, there's this one time you were blown up, and there was smoke, and the bullets were flying. And I think Hollywood gets this completely wrong. They act as if it's all one big action movie, when in fact, if you did a 15-month deployment, if you did one 15-month deployment in Iraq, think about that. That's 30 times 15, whatever it is. That's hundreds and hundreds of days being there and sleeping, hearing, hearing indirect fire, mortars, and IEDs every day, every night when you go to sleep, if you sleep at all. So it is this larger cumulative impact of the war that affects you too. And then the process of coming home is remarkably stressful. You think it's going to be this great homecoming fantasy of food, and intimacy and all your friends and beer. And there are parts of that. But then after a while, you find that you've changed remarkably, but the rest of the world has not. And so you're suddenly, if PTSD is a disease of time, then homecoming is this process of discovering that you have fallen out of time and that you need to reassemble yourself to fit in again.
How long did it take you, Dave, to get to where you could recount the basic events of those really traumatic days that you described, sort of like, and I mean this with no disrespect, like you're reading them off the back of a cereal box, like with no emotion in your voice? Is that simply something that you learned to do so that you could tell this story over and over that comes up in this work that you do? Or is that sort of the result of a process of retelling the story so many times that it doesn't have the same impact for you?
Well, it's interesting because I don't really have a good answer for you. I wish I had a simpler answer, but sometimes I can't tell a story. But I have, as you suggest, told the story of being blown up in Baghdad, you know, probably 200 times now. And at first, when I came back, I didn't tell anyone. And then the first time I told my girlfriend at the time what had happened, it was really stressful and I didn't know. It was kind of, and it's weird when you first, and this is, I think, important to know, is when you ask veterans about their war experience, like for me, I could feel my face heat up and the blood, like that my blood would seem to heat up, like there was this toxin that I had picked up in Iraq and I could feel it in my blood again, which I know sounds frightening, but it does take, and what that is your body physiologically responding with cortisol and other stress hormones to the memory of that event, and your body's pumping out adrenaline. And it takes a while, and you have to do it gently, and you have to be the person asking needs to be very present and be the best listener they can be, and the veteran needs to try to be the best storyteller they can be to get those stories out and to have them heard. And that sounds like a silly, trivial thing to say. Like everyone, we continue to have this conversation about how do we thank veterans? What do we do with them? How do we honor them properly? And I'm here to tell you that the way to honor a vet properly is to be the best audience you can be for their stories and be the best listener you can be. And pay listening is such a poor American skill. We do such a bad job of listening. And I think if you listen properly and process the fullness of a veteran story or a rape survivor story, you stand to learn a lot. Veterans and rape survivors and people that have survived earthquakes have seen their society at its extreme. As a Marine, I felt like I saw, and as a war correspondent in Iraq, I felt like I saw American history pushed to its edge. And I wanted people to understand that. And so rarely did I meet someone in the United States who was willing to take my story with the fullness that I wanted it to be heard. People typically responded, to be perfectly honest, with very racist comments about Arabs, you know, which is not helpful. And then on the other extreme, people would tell me, you know, what a giant fool George W. Bush was and how we needed to develop alternative energies and really how it was all about oil anyway. And so there, I think there is this, and I've heard this from other people, not Americans overseas, in my travels, that Americans we're not very good listeners, you know. And I certainly don't consider you in this category as I continue to talk at you, but that's one thing I think we need to do. And I don't think, you know, to be perfectly honest, I don't think these movies like American Sniper are really helping us. I don't. They're these Disneyfied, you know, cinematic, you know, almost pornographic parades of visual imagery that obscure the war, that myth make about it, rather than get at the heart of it.
Yeah, you're over this. I guess it's a well-meaning but really simplistic narrative that we've created, the civilian world has created, to call every military veteran a hero. Can you talk about why that really sort of destroys any possibility for meaningful conversation as far as you're concerned?
Well, I have to say, you know, I used to really hate it when people would thank me for my service. It drove me crazy. And I know some Marines felt the same way. They felt it was like a cheap. It was more about the person thanking you than your service. And the times I have been thanked for my service, one time it was during a brush fire when my neighborhood was on fire, and the woman was very, who thanked me for my service, was very upset and very emotionally engaged. And so that felt strange. But it still is better, you know, if you compare what veterans, the experience they have now compared to what Vietnam veterans have, it's a way better place to be the way we are now. And so I don't want to say, don't thank me for reserve. Because Vietnam vets, that causes a lot of PTSD, because then you think that America hates you. And that has a serious measurable impact in who gets PTSD. However, I feel like if we're just going to turn everybody into these portraits, these oil portrait heroes or these bronze statues, you know, you can't have a conversation with a statue. You can't get up there on the equestrian statue and say, hey, tell me what it was like in Ramadi. Tell me what it was like in Cop Falcon. Tell me what it was like at Shantosh when you were there with 3rd Battalion, 7th Marines. What were the snipers like there? What was it like to be dealing with people that had just tried to be killing you the last year? And so I feel like Americans have not really spent the time to – they want to worship Chris Kyle. They want to worship American heroes, but they're not – they want to worship heroes from a distance, and they don't want to really understand the messy, conflicting, paradoxical, confusing, fascinating, mystical, you know, heartbreaking, head-breaking experiences that soldiers, that veterans have. And because it's inconvenient, because it's hard to process. It ruins the idea we have of these perfect heroes, these Teflon heroes that can do anything, and these unstoppable killing machines that can survive under any circumstances. That's part of it, but there are a lot of other parts too. I mean, there's a lot of – one of the things that Iraq taught me was that bullets only get you so far, you know. I met a lot of Marines, 3rd Battalion, 7th Marines from 29 Palms, California. Great, great Marine battalion. They had done two tours in Ramadi, lost a lot of Marines to the al-Qaeda insurgents there, came back 18 months later, and began working with the same tribes, with the same people that had been killing them. And had been hiding al-Qaeda terrorists for years because they understood that they had that engaging with the local Iraqis and actually partnering with them and helping them achieve a greater sense of security was the only way forward. And, you know, obviously a lot of these tactical gains have been overturned by ISIS. But in terms of the forward progress that was ever made in Iraq, the lion's share of that was not done through killing. You know, killing was a big part of it. There were some people that needed to be killed, and we killed them. But there were a lot of Iraqis that were just in the way. And things, the greatest progress that we achieved in Anbar province was through partnering with the locals, not killing them all. And I think that's an important thing. You know, Americans have a really hard time accepting Iraqis as human beings. The American Sniper, the movie, and Hurt Locker do a very poor job of this, in my opinion. They never... The Iraqis, if they're on screen at all, are merely backdrop to the great American heroes that are killing their way to victory in the foreground. And to me, that's not only incorrect, that is a big part of the problem in the country today. That's one of the reasons we went to war in the first place, is that people had this idea that we could kill our way to victory. And I'm here to tell you, as someone who spent an extraordinary amount of time studying counterinsurgency and you know, in the killing zone, that ain't how it is.
Talk a little bit about your experiences with going to the VA when you finally realized, I guess in some ways to your surprise, that you had been affected by PTSD. How you interacted with the professionals there and the ways in which they were and were not helpful.
Well, I mean, this kind of goes back to my earlier point. I mean, the VA, and I need to be clear up front, the VA is not, they are not the bad guys. The U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs, particularly now since we have a new secretary in place, they are the world lead agency for treating PTSD. They are a clearinghouse of PTSD research and treatment. They are way better now than they were in the 1970s when the first Vietnam veterans came back. They're way better now than they were in 2005. However, interestingly, the VA does not really offer much in the way of individualized psychotherapy where you go in and talk to an individual clinician. What I was offered and what is part of the larger VA campaign of evidence-supported treatments, I was offered a one-size-fits-all checklist type of therapy known as prolonged exposure, which does work 60% of the time. But it is known to make people's PTSD worse in 28% of cases. So there is, and with prolonged exposure, the idea is that you are asked to, I, for instance, was asked to retell the story of my IED ambush in Baghdad dozens and dozens and dozens of times. And the theory behind this is that if you tell the story over and over again, eventually that memory will lose its traumatic charge. And in fact, this therapy made my symptoms much worse. I couldn't sleep, I couldn't read, and I certainly couldn't write. And when I tried to go out for a run, my body was so activated that both my calf muscles spasmed, like locked up. So I think that the VA still has a long way to go. And I think, interestingly, even though the VA spends more money on PTSD research than any organization, more than the UN, more than the EU, more than Kaiser Permanente, you know, more than any other HMO, there still is this very medical, siloed, like really close-minded, one-size-fits-all medical view of what trauma is and what war trauma is. And one example I have of this is some of the first interviews I did with VA investigators at the VA San Diego, which is one of the largest VAs on the West Coast. The person I was talking to who'd been doing research for almost 30 years didn't know where Fallujah was. She'd never read the works of Tim O'Brien. And when I told her, well, I was in Iraq, not as a Marine, but as a reporter in Ramadi, Fallujah, Haditha, Baghdad, Qaim, you know, several other places, she said, well, then you probably didn't see much, I guess. And so there is this lack of sort of global war on terror one-on-one of like what a combat engineer does, what a sniper's daily life is like, what a, you know, someone who's involved in civil affairs does. And I was really surprised. And the one thing I did for my therapist was bring him a copy of Tom Rick's Fiasco, which is this Pulitzer Prize-winning history of the first 2 years of the Iraq War, which he did not have time to read and did not read. You know, he was a graduate student. He was very busy, and he had to do, you know, he was being trained and had, you know, and had a lot of other commitments and responsibilities. But there is this very, very poor sense of what actually the nuts and bolts of military life that goes on at the VA. Because, again, you know, this is one of the central concerns I have with PTSD when I looked at the history of it. PTSD nowadays is treated in roughly the same manner as you would treat strep throat. You come in, you get a diagnosis, you know, we try to keep that diagnosis from, we try to keep the contagion of trauma spreading. So we're going to go through these questions in the most antiseptic manner possible. And we're going to try to just ask the questions on a yes or no basis and not really get into the messy details too much. And then we treat it with this very one size fits all therapeutic protocol that is literally taken out of a checklist. So we go down, you know, one by one, we do this, and then we cure people, right? And so it's not really humanized or thought about in this larger, and the moral concerns and the ethical, spiritual concerns of veterans are completely ignored.
We're speaking this hour with journalist and Marine Corps veteran David J. Morris about his new book, The Evil Hours, a biography of post-traumatic stress disorder. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for summer and fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Marine Corps veteran and journalist David J. Morris. His new book is The Evil Hours, a biography of post-traumatic stress disorder. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. And that's where we find Lawrence on the line in Carrollton. Hi, Lawrence.
Hi, Chris. Mr. Morris. I know that there are a few alternative therapies out there. I'm aware of one called the recapitulation technique, and I just wonder if you have looked into any of those with regard to them ameliorating the effects of prior trauma, et cetera.
I'm not personally familiar with recapitulation therapy. I did interview a number of alternative therapists, and in particular, one friend of mine, a woman who had survived rape as a young woman, and for her, yoga had turned out to be a very powerful therapy for her. Traditional Western talk therapies do not work for a number of people, and for her, she found that the first time she felt safe and loved and in better accord with her body and in a sort of a better, more useful conversation with her body was after she went to a yoga retreat in Canada and studied Sivananda yoga And that process for her was her way of achieving a kind of harmony with her physical person, which had been damaged as a result of being raped. And that was, and yoga, the VA is beginning to experiment with yoga and offer that to veterans as a therapeutic modality, which I think is wise. I think the VA should do much, much, much more of that. Yoga has a zero side effect profile. It's common. It's available. It's something where it actually, you get out in the community and you meet different people, and you're involved in achieving a kind of peace through your body and getting your mind and your body in better harmony. So as far as my in particular favorite, I think yoga, because it is so different than your traditional talk therapies and speaks to a different aspect of your humanity, can be particularly helpful. I did also take part in a mindfulness therapy experiment at the VA, which is one of the other major non-Western therapeutic modalities that's being explored. And in this particular study I took part in, which had a good result, was known as a mantra repetition study. So you would pick a verse from the Bible or a Hindu phrase with religious import, and you would repeat that to yourself, and that, and the act of doing that would help you live more in the present and bring a kind of mindfulness and centeredness. And there were 7 people in the study with me. I was the only one who didn't particularly care for it, because I have ADD or something. But everyone else, and a Marine I knew from 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines, who'd done 7 deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan, said it really worked for him. And so I think there are a number of alternative therapies that are out there that are very helpful. And most of these, like yoga, for example, has no particular view about trauma. Its goal is to bring the mind and body into better harmony, which is important. And it speaks to the idea that PTSD, you know, we have this very medical view of it that we can treat it with this medicine that we've tested scientifically. Which is good, but there are other ways that are more integrative and that approach humans on a more spiritual level and on a more mindful level that I think are very useful. So I'm sorry. I mean, actually, as I looked into the alternatives for PTSD, I discovered that there weren't just dozens, there weren't just scores of alternative therapies, there were hundreds. I had people emailing me that told me that Tetris was really helpful for them. I heard people that told me this hot water therapy was very helpful for them, service dogs. Working at a horse ranch that a friend of mine started in the mountains of Southern California, all of which seemed to have some therapeutic effect. So there were very few therapies that I thought were really destructive or negative. So my personal opinion is that, if it works for you, there's no such thing as a placebo effect in psychiatry. If you feel better, then you are better.
You've been very articulate in explaining the barriers between people who have PTSD and combat veterans in particular and the general public. What do you think gets in the way of veterans who might have quite similar experiences having meaningful conversations that might be helpful with one another?
With other veterans?
Yeah.
I don't know. I have a number of Marine veterans and Iraq buddies of mine. We share similar stories and values. I think one thing that is a problem is that, and I think this is true in Texas and North Texas particularly, you come back from the war and you go to Fort Hood and then you're discharged 3 months later, say, and then you go home. And then you go back to Weatherby, or you go back to Plano, and you're not around your unit anymore, and you don't know anybody. Any veterans you know had a totally different experience, different theater of the war. They were a different unit, different MOS, etc. And I think the military doesn't do a very good job of supporting the fraternal associations and the reunion process that happens, which both the British and the French militaries do. The French military has the Legionnaires' home. I mean, France has a much smaller military than we do, mind you. But I don't know why there's not more being done to help veterans have reunions. And one Marine unit in particular, 2nd Battalion, 4th Marines from Camp Pendleton, always has their, and they took more casualties than any equivalent unit in all of the wars after 9/11. They suffered, I believe it was 28 killed in Ramadi in 2004, if I'm getting the numbers right. They hold a reunion every year in Texas, last time I heard. They were holding it in Texas. and they have to pay, you know, people fly from all over the country, Minnesota, California, Florida, to come to the reunion in Texas. And I don't know why there's a lot more that could be done to help that reunion process, you know, even just, the VA paying for it or in some way hosting it or helping build some sort of infrastructure for it, as is done in other militaries. You know, we live in a very large country. Texas is a huge state. Everyone's spread out all over the place. And when we get discharged, we go back home and we lose all those relationships that we could have.
It's sort of a classic narrative that undiagnosed PTSD sufferers or those who don't want to go the medicalized route, as you described it, will turn to drugs and alcohol. Is that always a bad idea? Is there a possibility that there might be, at very moderate levels, some therapeutic effect to these sort of self-prescribing behaviors that so many veterans seem to turn to?
Well, I think there's two questions in what you just said, and I'll address them individually. First off, I should say I love beer. I'm a huge craft beer nerd. I went to Texas A&M. One of my good Aggie buddies works for the Great American Beer Festival in Colorado. I love talking about beer, and some of the most thoughtful and reflective people and the best listeners I've ever heard about towards veterans are craft beer bartenders in San Diego. I had a great conversation with this one in San Marcos, not far from the Miramar Air Station. And he said, you know, I think the veterans come in and I really need to hear their story. And so alcohol taken in moderation can be this very helpful medium that helps midwife a conversation, helps a conversation happen. You know, I'm not here to say everyone should have, you know, a six pack and then that's going to solve their problems. You know, you have to keep it, you know, like Winston Churchill said, alcohol is a great servant, but a terrible master. If you take that on and use alcohol as your servant, you can get limited benefits from it. Secondarily to that, there's been a lot of beneficial and profitable research done into investigating the use of ecstasy, MDMA, and marijuana in reducing PTSD symptoms. And I'll start with ecstasy first. Ecstasy was first developed by a psychiatrist to treat people who had traumatic experiences. It was first invented as a therapeutic pharmaceutical. And when you take a drug like that, it does reduce your anxiety. It does open your mind up to greater stimuli that you can process. And arguably, it brings you into a mystical type state. Anthropologists have done a lot of research on what they call entheogens, and drugs like ecstasy and other drugs that Indians of northern Mexico took to achieve a mystical union with the universe. This is very common throughout history. And so the idea that an illegal drug like MDMA, like ecstasy, could be helpful is, on the one hand, very controversial, but also unsurprising, because it has the potential to knock away a lot of the stimulus barriers and the normal mindset that people live in on a daily basis, and allow you to engage the universe on a more elemental, mystical level. But there's one Canadian researcher was trying to research MDMA, and it took her years to get it cleared. And the ecstasy that she got to do her studies with, she has to keep in a vault in Toronto. And so there's this paranoia that, you know, if we let the genie out of the bottle, everyone's going to do ecstasy and chaos will ensue. But, you know, we've had this conversation about marijuana as well, and we're just now beginning to accept that human beings can self-medicate to a degree. And so I encourage, and, you know, earlier we were talking about alternative therapies. I think MDMA and weed hold the potential to be extraordinarily powerful. They have a... You know, weed wasn't, you know, these sorts of entheogens and other drugs like this, Americans didn't invent them. Westerners didn't invent them. They've been around forever. And people have used them like they use any other technology, for both for good and for bad. And so I encourage and I hope that the VA will support more research into the use of ecstasy and marijuana as under controlled conditions as a therapy.
We have an email here from Kim who writes, absolutely right about not listening. I was in a store with my mom and someone asked me about danger in Baghdad. As soon as my mom heard the word rockets, she became wound up and chatty. I never finished my answer and never brought up the war with my family again, and they never asked.
Yeah, and I think you do have to be careful, because sometimes people, when they're asked about the war, don't know what to say, and they get... they can have a flood of memory and emotions from their experience. And so it does take time, which means, you know, that when somebody has a strong emotional response to a question, that doesn't mean you should never ask that question again. It just means you need to find a better way to ask the question, and or to find a way, and this is an instance where a little bit of alcohol can be helpful, to have a more settled, more in-depth, more meaningful on the porch, you know, thinking about life from a remove kind of experience. And that was, you know, I think one of the, that's one of the most powerful experiences, you know, every veteran, you know, and I had some very strong experiences with this in Iraq, talking to this one Marine sergeant minutes before he was wounded. He told me, you know, I when I go home, I tell my wife everything. I try to get it all out because I don't want her, I don't want to become a monster to her. I don't want her to become something that she can't understand. And so, you know, and then this Marine from 1st Battalion, 1st Marines, Camp Pendleton, and then a minute later he was wounded and lost the use of his legs, last time I heard. And, you know, so these sorts of, you need to have these, you know, the both parties need to get better at this conversation. It's not all veterans need to get better. We need to become better storytellers, which is why reading helps and why we should read more and think about how the manner in which we tell our stories. And people need to be better listeners. You know, we need to sit with these stories and be with these stories and think about them, internalize them, and incorporate the wisdom that we find in veteran stories into our lives. And I think at its highest, I mean, that's what's so amazing about the experience of like John McCain and the Hanoi Hilton group of prisoners of war. Those people came back, and that particular cohort has a really, really, really low PTSD lifetime diagnosis rate. Those veterans came back and were treated like returning astronauts, and their stories have been told and retold and converted into like this almost homily, this type of wisdom literature of, you know, this is how you survive the worst circumstances. You know, you do these things. And I think we need to treat veterans and, you know, we need to try to hear veteran stories more in that spirit of like, you saw the most amazing things and you survived. What's that like? You know, and try to get to the meat of the experience and not just thank people for their service and say racist things about Arabs. You know, let's make this a real conversation, not a soundbite. Let's not just read from the bumper sticker to each other.
We just have about 30 seconds left, but I wonder, Dave, if you are now resigned to continuing to try to get better, but never being entirely well.
I sort of reject the premise. I sort of think of it as I'm just different. Mm-hmm. I'm not the person. I don't expect to become the same person anymore. I noticed that over the course of writing this book, my attitudes evolved a lot. And I just expect that, you know, PTSD is a disease of time. And as much as you can't go back in time, you can't step in the same river twice. You've got to go forward and you've got to think about living in the now in the best way you can. And for me, almost dying several times was really scary, but also really exciting, and I want to maintain that excitement and think about how to live really authentically and, you know, in a way that is more rich and alive because of having almost died. So that's I don't think of healing or curing PTSD. I think of becoming the new person that you need to be.
David J. Morris is a veteran of the U.S. Marine Corps, and he reported as a war correspondent from Iraq from 2004 to 2007. His new book is The Evil Hours, a biography of post-traumatic stress disorder. Dave, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Hey, thanks, Chris. Good to be here.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Kristen Taylor. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.